Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 12, September 24th, 2005. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to another show of Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow and I'm the host. Today's show is full of information, so my part is going to be short. First, we're going to have an interview with Sandra Rogers about a short 5-minute film she created called The Law. It's a day in the life of a Thelemite. Then we're going to have an interview with Keith 418 in our ongoing series. And this time we're going to be talking about class and how it plays out in the Thelemic community. And when I say class, I mean social class. And then the last interview is with Cindy Weinstein, and we're going to be discussing the unified feminine and the goddess Babylon, and how working with that current and those energies and that deity can help somebody work through various things and work towards doing their will. Before I get into those segments, though, I want to say thank you to Storm and Sorsha from the Wicked Podcast. They interviewed me about a week ago, and I should be on their show in the next week or so. So keep an eye out for that, or I guess an ear out. And then also I want to thank the people who have been sending postcards. I've gotten a number of them already. I got one from Sassy in Bronx, New York. She sent a very cool postcard of a hand-drawn picture of Crowley that she made with a universal hexagram. Also got one from, from Alistair in Devon, England. He sent a very cool postcard that has a picture of the formula of Zos of Thanatos by Austin Spare. That's pretty cool. Got a great postcard from Canada from Gwendolyn. Also got some postcards from Jason in Ocean Park, Washington. Carolyn in Iowa City. She also included on here a Swinburne poem. And I got a cool old postcard from Philip in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Keep the postcards coming. I don't have the stickers yet. They'll be another 2 to 3 weeks. There was a problem at the printer, and in fact, I'm going to be getting a different printer. So I hope to have those by the mid to end of October. So I hope those of you who have sent postcards will be patient with me, please. And those who haven't had sent a postcard yet, please do so. They will be coming out in October. Anyway, let's get into the podcast with Sandra Rogers.
We have on the phone Sandra Scott Rogers. Are you there, Sandra?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast.
Thank you. And 93, John.
93. Now, you have done a short called The Law, A Day in the Life of a Thelemite. And you also have done a number of other productions, including produced a movie called 73 Virgins, and you work with a company called Brickyard Hill.
Yes, I have. I've actually been in the industry for a little over 15 years.
15 years. Excellent. Mm-hmm. And when you created The Law, what was your reasoning behind making that short film?
Well, the very first reasoning behind it was to enter it into a contest. I have been, as of late, transitioning from strictly producing into directing. And when I saw the opportunity to do a contest based on the concept of how do people pray, I thought of it was a good opportunity to show what maybe the day in the life of an average Thelemite might be. So I took it upon myself to kind of merge together my passion in my career with my passion for myself, which is Voima.
Now, what was the contest? Was it something of how do you pray in your religion?
Yeah, it was called Current Soul, and they stated that they were looking for a diverse showing of how people connect to the divine. So that was, it was a very loosely kind of orchestrated. So I went into it. It had a time limit of 5 minutes, and I set up what I wanted to shoot, and a lot of which I ended up not shooting, and some of which I did shoot that I couldn't end up using because of the time constraint of 5 minutes. So I decided to go with the idea of one person, what an average sort of day might be like. And I was really, really wanted to put the creed from the Mass in there, and that took up a lot of time. But it was really important to me because it's very important in my life, and I have just recently taken my confirmation about the time that I was filming this. So I ended up having to not cover some of the asana and pranayama and other sorts of daily practices to make room for the creed.
Have you thought about putting out an extended version?
I have. I've thought about reshooting it. Some of the footage that came out a little darker than I wanted, and making it maybe into a longer piece.
Did you film it yourself, or did you have assistance?
I actually filmed it myself, sometimes having the remote control. I had like a week and a half to film and edit it. I found out at the very last minute. Sometimes my daughter just started the camera for me, or my husband, but most of the time it was just me.
Well, I think it came out pretty good. What kind of feedback have you gotten about it?
I've gotten pretty positive feedback. I've gotten most of it from Thelemites that understand what it's about.
Uh-huh.
I have one gentleman, that I'm not sure who it is, that commented on the Current TV website that he wished I had put more into it. And since I don't know how to get in touch with him, I kind of wanted to tell him I would like to have. I just didn't have the time to do it. But I also wanted to come at it from the standpoint of, this is me. I'm not trying to say what anybody else might do during their day, but this is what I do. That's why it's me in front of the camera and behind the camera.
Did you win?
I did not.
Did you place anywhere in
I did not.
Okay.
However, what ended up coming out of it was that they contacted me and asked me my permission to air it on their website for 3 months, which I gave them, and then that opens up a whole other opportunity. If you go to the website and view my video, and if you like it, and you would like to see it on TV, you have the opportunity to greenlight it.
Mm.
And then if enough people do this, maybe there's a chance it might get on TV.
And when you say TV, what kind of station would play it?
It is a new cable channel called Current TV.
I see. Okay. Do they have exclusive rights to this?
They have rights to air it exclusively on the internet for the first 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then if somebody else wanted to purchase it, I have to give them the opportunity first. But other than that, I maintain all rights of it.
Well, I think this is a great example of combining one's creativity with one's thelemic beliefs. Has your thelemic beliefs influenced other creative projects of yours?
This was the first one that I attempted to do with my specifically titled thelemic beliefs. I was introduced to the idea of thelema about a year and a half ago. At the time, I was a Thelemite. I just didn't know it. I'd never heard the word before. But with the work that I've been doing over the last year and a half personally, has really pushed me to make that leap from strictly producing to directing, which is something that I've always wanted to do, but I'd fallen into being a good producer. So, yes, it has influenced me just in the fact that it got me to do something. This is the first thing that I have actually directed myself.
Do you have any other future projects coming up?
I have a couple that I'm sort of tossing around. I don't have anything set in stone yet.
Are you currently producing any movies?
No.
No? Okay. So you're kind of in between point.
Yeah, I'm in between. With Brickyard Hill Films, we're sort of constantly in development on certain projects, but nothing's actually with a set production date.
And Brickyard Hill was involved with the 73 Virgins production?
No, the 73 Virgins was a freelance production I did.
Okay. And that won some awards, though.
It did. It made it into 5 or 6 film festivals. And here in Los Angeles, it aired at the New York Independent International Film and Video Festival and won the Best Grand Jury for Best Short.
Well, that is great. I'm glad that you could be on the podcast. I know this was short, but I wanted to make people aware of your short film and kind of give you an opportunity to talk about it a little. And
thank
I will
you very much.
Oh, and I will have a link to it on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. And also, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, is there an email they could email you at?
Yes, they can email me at Sondra, S-O-N-D-R-A, at Brickyard Hill, which is exactly how it sounds, a brick, a yard, and then a hill, .org.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
93.
I want to remind people to go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website where you'll see a link to Current TV and Sondra's movie and watch the movie. It's really good. And then also give it a green light and let's see if we can all pull together to give enough thumbs up to the movie and get it broadcast on Current TV. The next segment is with Keith 418. We've looked at a lot of different things in the Thelemic community, and today we're going to be talking about social class and how the various social classes are bringing values and expectations to the Thelemic community and how those are playing out, especially within the leadership of the OTO.
Hello, Keith. You there?
Yeah. Hi, 93. Sir.
Hey, 93. I have been thinking about class issues lately, and one of the things that I notice about the OTO and a lot of other Thelemic organizations is that the leadership seems to be coming from the middle classes, whereas the majority of the membership are in the working classes. And so you get this kind of dichotomy, and then you every once in a while get somebody coming in who works their way up through the system, and when they show themselves to be middle class and have middle class values and be responsible like a middle class person and have property or, you know, have their own house, or they kind of gravitate towards the leadership. Have you seen the same thing, or and what do you
think
about class?
Well, I think we need to be very careful about studying the class relationships in the OTO, and I think we need to take a lot of time to investigate them, because I think class values and class issues are determining in a lot of ways for individuals, and especially in ways that Americans are trained to reject or to avoid thinking about. There isn't a great deal of discussion about class in this country. We often have this sort of national myth that America is a country that's free of class. This is a myth in that it's not true, but I think it's really important to confront class values and how they impact on the Thelemic community, because I think that they are, you know, determining. I think people don't really want to recognize the extent that their tastes, their values, what they think is good, what they think is bad, what they think is in good taste, what they think is in bad taste, what they think is worth putting energy into, what they think is not worth putting energy into, who they look up to, who they look down on, all these things are greatly determined by class. And, you know, a friend of mine was saying recently that people hang around the occult community because they think that they are autonomous individuals and autonomous subjects, totally free of these sorts of determining factors, where in fact that's nonsense. That's just not true. And if the occult is really going to produce autonomous subjects, people that are free of all of these sorts of influences, then it has to confront them. It has to look at them. We have to examine ourselves to see how much of our own values, our own tastes are really determined by our social class. So I think that's important. I think you need to look at the difference between, for example, the middle-class leaders of the current organization and the previous leaders who started the OTO in the 70s, or restarted it, I should say, and then even look at the class patterns that you can see going back in the 1940s with the Agape Lodge people. And one of the things that I think is really interesting and has become sort of the folk history of the OTO, if you will, is that the Grady era people were hippies. They were more what we would call lumpen class members, either dispossessed members of the working class or dispossessed members of the middle class who were into drugs, who you know, had this sort of countercultural sensibility left over from the 60s and 70s, and that these people sort of are responsible for a lot of the, quote, problems, that, unquote, that you see in the OTO. And in fact, the people who are criticizing this group of people and the people surrounding the Grady milieu are middle-class people who see the values of the lumpen and the hippie kind of druggy community as being inherently problematic. So naturally, they're going to look back at the Grady people and criticize them. And sometimes they do this very openly. They'll say, oh, the problems in the OTO that we're having really were started because of Grady and his buddies, and we're still working to sort of recover from them. And the attitude is they failed. They weren't able to really run the organization the way it needed to be run. And the middle class has come in to save the OTO and sort of bring with it responsible values to make the organization more tasteful, to make it more formal, and to sort of elevate it away from its grubby origins in slimy, hippie, wacky behavior. This description itself is a sort of model of class attitudes and class beliefs. And in fact, I mean, I would argue that, yes, the lumpen hippie characters that we associate with the Grady period were unsuccessful in many areas in running the organization. And in many ways, we can say they clearly failed. But I don't think the middle class members of the organization who've replaced them are necessarily free of problems. I think their own middle-class values are kind of rubbing up against and in conflict with Aleister Crowley's own ideas about the OTO. I mean, let's be frank. Crowley was not a fan of the middle class. He puts them down constantly through his writing. It's not difficult to find Aleister Crowley taking shots at them and their values. So the idea that the middle class could sort of come in and take over a thelemic organization like the OTO based on Aleister Crowley's principles and not have conflicts with their class values and positions is, to me, completely insane. And I think that's exactly what's happening. So those are the sorts of things we need to look at and examine when it comes to which class of people we're talking about. And there's a difference, I think, between working class people who, you know, in America may perform work in the trades, carpenters, electricians. Some of these people are very skilled. They're much more skilled than they had to be in previous years. I have a friend who's a journeyman electrician, and he's, you know, has to take all these tests and do all this work. It's not easy at all, and it is intellectually demanding. You know, these people do have, you know, markedly different class values and tastes than upper middle class managers and people associated perhaps with engineering, IT kind of jobs. And I think it's interesting to see, well, you know, how do these people get along, and how do they, you know, all contribute to the way the OTO looks. Now, there's also a difference between lumpen proletariat or lumpen working class people and the lumpen middle class. And I think that we need to study this because in many cases, some of the problems that the thelemic communities run into are with lumpen proletariat. These are people that Karl Marx talked about and many Marxists have described as being basic thugs. I mean, crooks, drug dealers, criminals, you know, people that are on the outskirts of society who are really, in many cases, operating in criminal enterprises. These people are the lumpen proletariat. It's not difficult to find people in the occult community who really don't want to hang out with these people. They draw the line with them. And a lot of the hostility or panic you see in the occult community comes when you discover, oh, wait a second, you know, so-and-so has a felony record, or, you know, so-and-so is a criminal. We don't have a hard time excluding those people. The lumpen middle class are very different. These are people who are on SSI or disability. These are people who whose parents or whose family basically was middle class, but who have left the middle class for a variety of reasons, maybe bad early marriages, you know, mental health problems, etc. And these people, you know, form a sort of different kind of community and are often attracted to the occult world, the occult milieu. So we see their impact as well. And the middle class, you know, running the organization has a very hard time, I think, bringing its values of, you know, middle class hard work and responsibility and, you know, equality, too, because this is a big part of being middle class and the way it operates through guilt trips and, you know, certain standards and ideas. It has a hard time bringing those values and melding them with the OTO and with Thelema. So in a lot of ways, we can see, yes, the lumpen hippie characters of the Grady period were challenged, but so are our current middle-class leaders. They're not having an easy time of it either, and you can see them struggling with the values they brought into it and then trying to make those fit somehow with Thelema. I don't think it works that well.
one of the things that I find interesting about the middle class is it's got its positives and negatives, and some of the positive things about it are usually responsibility, accountability, hard work, education.
Transparency,
one thing we've talked about before. So you have all of these things that we see in culture today, with the things that we demand of our government, the things that we demand of our businesses.
And of each other as middle-class agents.
Exactly. However, those are not things that the middle-class leaders within the OTO and other Thelema communities are demanding of the membership. And instead, the middle class has a lot of other problems, including the inability to really judge people and hold people accountable on those judgments. And I don't mean like if they do right or wrong based on the rules, but although that is an issue at times, but to really ask people to be dedicated to what they're doing and hold people accountable for that and to cut people off. So you have those kind of problems which lead to free riding and freeloading in the OTO and other organizations. And then you also have the inability to really do hold people accountable for their actions because you want to give them another chance.
Well, there's a conflict going on there. And I think that the larger conflict that you're talking about is if we have middle-class agents involved in the OTO and applying serious middle-class values to the creation of the Blue Equinox OTO, which is the short term that we usually use for Crowley's model, then what they're going to create is an institution and a sort of cultural milieu which is itself hostile to the middle class. So it's basically asking very industrious, hardworking people to very industriously and hardworkingly construct a mechanism which will destroy them and their values. That's what I see the paradox as being. It's like we all expect the middle class to follow through on its commitments and to say, hey, you know, you're the middle class. Where's your middle class accountability, your transparency, your hard work, your demands, your standards, your goals, your strategic planning? Where are all those things? Those are the things you promised us, and those are the things you're good at. Why won't you bring them to the OTO? And the reason they won't, I think, is because bringing all of those things to the OTO would create a system that is itself hostile to them and their class. So you're asking them basically to construct a gun that will shoot them.
Well, if they see that, then why do they come to the OTO in the first place?
Well, because I think that in a lot of ways, the OTO, like a lot of occult groups, you know, if we were straight Marxists, we would say that it is there to deal with the alienation and the lack of meaning and purpose that middle-class life in America assumes most of the time. And a lot of the time I think that people think that the OTO can be altered to make it acceptable and easier for middle class people to deal with. So you sort of have the opposite of initiation. You know, usually in initiation you approach the organization ready to transform yourself in accord with it. With the middle class OTO members, they approach the Lima and expect the Lima to alter itself to them and their demands and their values and their tastes. That, to me, isn't going to work as well, but we'll see how they do with it. I mean, to me, a lot of this is still an experiment that's we're in the middle of. We don't know how it's going to turn out. Now, a lot of people thought that the hippie Grady people could create the OTO. They couldn't do it. Now a lot of people think the middle-class members who are, as you point out, assuming more and more leadership positions, they think they can do it. Well, I don't think they can, but we have to see. I mean, they're being challenged right and left by people who are saying, hey, look, you know, where are the goals? Where are the standards? Where's the transparency? Where are all the things that we expect from you good, hardworking, accountable middle-class people? And you can see they're having a problem bringing that game to the OTO. Why is that?
One of the funny things that I think is happening is they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, really. Because if they change the order too much, then a whole bunch of people will leave. And regardless of what direction, if they go more towards the Blue Equinox, a bunch of people who don't like Crowley will leave the order. And if they don't go towards the Blue Equinox, a lot of the people who came to the order will see them not going towards that, and then will leave the order. And if they just kind of keep the status quo, a lot of people will get dissatisfied with the non-movement and leave the order.
Yes.
So they really are in a rock and a hard place.
They are. And they have to commit to a direction. And one of the things that I think is fascinating is the way that we can see them sort of squirm when you ask them to commit to their direction. You know, I make this this point regularly, that if we force them into a triangle, so to speak, to use, you know, ceremonial magical terms, they will say that their goal is the Blue Equinox OTO. I mean, they will say that if they are forced to, but they are not acting like it's a goal they're running toward. It's not like a goal that they're excited about or that they're really promoting. It's a goal that they will admit to when forced to. And how much of a goal could that ever be?
I think at one time they said, yes, Prophis houses are a goal of ours. I think they said that about a decade ago. We still haven't gotten any closer to it. We still don't have any Prophis house. It's not even on a plan or a timeline.
What middle-class group eschews property ownership and fundraising the way the OTO does? I mean, seriously, there is not... At one point, one of the leaders said to me, the OTO has all the money it needs. What nonprofit group would ever say that to anyone? This is a group that is terrified of owning property. If you bring up property on a discussion, OTO leaders immediately pop up to tell you why it's not practical, why it can't be done. They're not encouraging. They're not saying, oh, this is a goal of ours. Oh, this is really important. This is what we need to start thinking about. They're not leading anyone towards owning property. They're terrified of the idea of property. That is not middle class. The middle class did not get where it is by being scared of property. Yet we have middle class leaders running the organization that are terrified of the OTO owning property.
Well, why do you think that is?
I mean, I think a lot of it is they don't trust the system they're operating. And I've used this analogy before. If we took 30 dedicated Quakers and said, okay, we're making you cardinals, and one of you is going to be a pope, and you're going to run the Roman Catholic Church, there would be a clash in values between the structure of Roman Catholicism and the way Quakers approach religion. Consequently, there is a clash between middle-class values of equality, democracy, everybody having an input, everybody being recognized as being politically equal. There's a contradiction between those kinds of values and the values that the OTO structure is based on. And we're seeing a conflict as people try to run an organization that is based on values they don't share. They're unwilling to confront that contradiction. And this contradiction is becoming more glaring and more obvious as more people start to look at it and go, wait a minute, you're not even coming through on the promises you made us.
We have come to the end of our time segment today. So perhaps on the next podcast, we can pick up from here.
Okay.
All right. Thanks again, Keith. 93.
Thanks for having me. 93.
Our last segment is with Cindy Weinstein. Cindy is the body master of LVX Oasis in Los Angeles and also has been a practicing Thelemite for about 8 years. She has a very interesting theory about the goddess Babylon within the Thelemic pantheon and the unified feminine. I hope you find her segment interesting and informing.
Welcome to the podcast, Cindy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
I'm doing very well. A lot of people have been talking about your presentation from the last Noticon, and you did a presentation about Babylon and your particular takes on Babylon from your personal work. So what makes your work and your approach to Babylon different from other people's works or writings about Babylon?
I think that a lot of what I do and what I have to say is a little bit bigger than what is conventionally thought of as working with the Babylon current. There's a lot of people that work with the dark side of the current, that work with this idea of this dark goddess, of this warrior goddess, a killer, death, sex, all of that. And I think that my approach to Babylon is, in my opinion, more balanced and more holistic. I think that she's bigger than that. There's a lot of women that are turned off by it because of the association with the whore and having sex with everybody that they see. And there's a lot of women that are turned off by it, or I should say men and women, turned off by it because it's so dark and creepy and scary. And just like working with the masculine energy that we Thelemites work with, the Horus energy, there's a much bigger picture. And I think that a lot of what people are attracted to is that bigger picture that allows them to work with it in their way without feeling like they're sinking into this hellish darkness. So I think that's the main draw or the main excitement about it, is that it's just a bigger picture of this god form.
Why do you think people think Babylon is so dark?
Well, most of what we know about Babylon, I mean, frankly, there's not very much to be known. We've overlaid a lot of stuff on the Apocalypse of St. John, the Babylon riding the beast, the whore, the harlot, the this dark, well, not dark, but evil goddess that, or angel that comes out riding this really terrifying beast. And so, whereas a lot of the work that's been done in the Thelemic current with the idea of the beast, Baryon, Horus, the masculine god form, has over the years balanced itself out, and we've kind of corrected that to some degree, the work with Babylon hasn't done that. It hasn't really been worked with to that same extent. So I think a lot of it is just carrying those overlays of the Christian viewpoint of Babylon, the whore of Babylon, and all of the scary, frightening, awful stuff that was written in John's vision.
So you're saying more of the promiscuous, sexual, liberated sexually Babylon is still, from the Christian viewpoint, is still seen negatively, and that is still kind of overlaid on a lot of people's values?
I think it is. I think that we've all got a lot of Judeo-Christian overlays that we carry with us, and it's really easy to take that one and run with it. I mean, frankly, there's still a lot of sexual repression. So when young women particularly find this Babylon idea that says they can have sex with anybody that they want to or anybody that comes to them or however it is that they interpret it, it's a really liberating force, and it's easy to latch onto. We've got the whole Gothic culture, the dark death, kind of macabre culture that a lot of people are involved in and into, and this fits very nicely into it. We've kind of gotten over the whole Satan thing, although not that long ago, but we've still got Babylon.
Right.
And so she plays really well into it. If you just look at Revelations, and even if you look at a lot of what's in the vision and the voice from Crowley, it plays really easily into that side of things. And that's been what's been out there. That's been her public face, so to speak, is this scary, dark, sexual goddess. Very much like Kali, which also, she also has a lot of misconceptions that are promulgated with her, very, very much the same as the Kali idea.
So your approach or inspiration about Babylon is a more holistic, accepting this, you know, darker, quote, darker side, but also other aspects. If that's the case, where did this come from? Where in your personal work did you get the inspiration from a more holistic vision or approach to Babylon?
That actually came from a couple of different directions, one of which I'm usually pretty hesitant to talk about because I have nothing to validate it with, but one of it is just, frankly, my own personal meditations and my own ritual work. Looking at the idea of this dark goddess and the idea of Saturn and Bina and all of the things that, you know, the Kabbalistic spheres that she's associated with, and just kind of diving in into some ritual work and some meditation and finding that once I got into that darkness, that darkness wasn't really dark at all, that darkness was extremely illuminating in the same way that light can be blinding. This was a darkness that really illuminated the interior regions of the soul, that allowed one to see into oneself and experience it without the active force impinging itself, because it is essentially, in its archetypal form, it's essentially the feminine receptive. So it was in those early experiences of, entering certainly with a lot of trepidation and a lot of concern about what it was that I was doing, but there was no real guidance anywhere. So I just sort of went in and found that this was not it's certainly a formidable current, but not only the in the way that it had been expressed before. And I think really its most formidable aspect is that idea of that illuminating darkness, that brilliant darkness. So that was one, that's one place that that came from. And the second avenue that that came in from is trying to trace where this idea came from. I have this story that I tell that's just burned in my memory of early on in my career, maybe even before I joined the Order or just after. So this is, you know, like maybe 8 years ago or so. I went into a bookstore because I was researching all of these new and strange God forms that I've been running into and studying Thelema, and I wanted to understand what Babylon was. And so I went to this bookstore that had this enormous women's spirituality section. I mean, just shelves and shelves and shelves. They had everything. And so I went looking for a book on Babylon. And you can laugh now because we all know that that doesn't exist. But I didn't. And so I thought, well, it must be in one of these books on goddesses. So I pulled out a whole bunch of books that had, you know, goddesses from the Middle East, goddesses from North Africa, blah, 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 on and on and on, and I didn't find it. So after I went through all of these books, I finally found this enormous volume of goddesses. And, you know, it's like, it was like 3 inches thick, and it was really heavy. And I pulled it out, and I looked in there, and there was nothing. There was just nothing anywhere. Apparently, neither the Western nor the Eastern world regarded Babylon as a goddess, and I couldn't believe it. So I went digging around, and to make a long story short, what I wound up finding through trying to find the source of where this Babylon idea came from is finding that it was almost non-existent, because every single goddess manifested part of what we knew that Babylon was. We think of Babylon as this whore. So, okay, they're in Western, Wiccan, Greek, pagan terms, that's the virgin, because the virgin is the one that has sex, or the maiden. And then there was this maternal aspect that she had, because, you know, we know that she's the womb, she's where everything is born. We know that from our creed. But there I just found mother goddesses that didn't have sex and weren't particularly intelligent. The virgins, by the way, were totally stupid and had nothing to say. And neither did the maidens. They had nothing wise to say either. So I found the crone. Well, the crone knows everything but doesn't have any sex and either has eaten her children or just doesn't have any and they're not mentioned. And I realized that what had happened was that the feminine aspect of the feminine god form had been utterly fractured. And I went back and I finally found Tiamat in, coincidentally, Sumerian, which would have been Babylonian theology, that was not yet fractured. I found Kali, who most people don't realize is not fractured. But for the most part, what I realized is that Babylon is this unified feminine. It's all three aspects that are generally portrayed as the feminine in one goddess, and that was what was so challenging about it, and that was what also made me realize that even as we were working with this Babylon current, our women, our Thelemic women were working with it, they were so accustomed to the fracture that they were not able to access the full spectrum of her essence. We've just become accustomed to the idea women's life has three stages. Women goddesses are either maidens, mothers, or crones. It's ingrained. And so that was the other avenue that led me to this idea that this is more than just whatever sexuality or this violence or this death dark side had, because that was only an aspect. And I really want to emphasize that, because that's one of the cornerstones of this work, is realizing how accustomed women and men, all of us, have become to subdividing the feminine, subdividing the female, even subdividing the women that we know personally, it's how our culture approaches women. And looking at a unified feminine implies that the maiden, literally the 17-year-old girl, can also be intelligent and can also be nurturing. The crone, the 70-year-old woman, can also be sexual and nurturing. The mother can be sexual and wise. And that's not an easy concept. That's a more challenging concept when you're trying to integrate it than it appears to be in intellectualizing it. So this idea of the unified feminine is extremely foreign to our culture, to most contemporary cultures. And Babylon is a unified feminine. And I think that that's one of the scariest things in terms of making internal changes and adjustments, one of the scariest things from an outsider looking in, because it's a very, very threatening idea. There's reasons that the feminine needed to be fractured. And we see male gods fractured to some degree also. And when we see that, we can easily see why it was actually politically astute to fracture a male god so that all of the power doesn't sit in one seat. It's a pretty simple political maneuver to divide and conquer. We've divided and conquered our gods and done ourselves a great disservice in the process. So I just wanted to really put a lot of emphasis on that idea of the unified feminine, that it's not a simple, oh yeah, that makes sense kind of thing, that once you get into it, it's a lot to deal with and a lot to work with, and you bump into walls where you're not ever expecting them.
Well, you mentioned power, and I could see having the unified feminine that has the totality of all aspects of femininity, everything from, as you're saying, the maiden, to even the fierceness that can be within the feminine, like what you were saying before, Kali and some of the other goddesses. What is the driver or the key to that power within the unified feminine?
I think that the biggest key to unlocking that is an idea that we have all long ago rejected, or at least relegated to the bad and should not do realm of things, and that's the idea of desire. Most of us in Western culture and a lot of people in Eastern culture have grown up with the idea that desire is more than anything the root of evil. That's a common Buddhist concept, and I think it's a common misconception that desire must be killed. Desire is what propels us forward. Desire is what causes us to create. And in a macrocosmic viewpoint, were it not for the desire of that singularity to experience itself, there would be no manifestation. There would never have been a logos uttered, which caused the creation of the vessel to contain it. That vessel that contains it would just absorb it forever unless it had some desire to shape it and express it. So it just, it keeps going. Desire is the source of duality, but it's also the source of unity. It's the way that will comes forth. It's the energy that drives will. And so the key to Babylon is that idea of desire. It's the desire, if you look at the Genesis stories, the desire on behalf of the woman for knowledge, for this apple from this forbidden tree. You can revisit that and certainly see where in another context that was not a terrible thing to do. It reshapes our mythology. The idea that desire isn't a bad thing, but can be accessed and utilized as a very raw creative force. And it unifies all of it. It unifies the feminine in her desire not only for physical union, but her desire to create, her desire for wisdom, for knowledge, her desire for expression. All of these things cannot happen if someone doesn't put in plain English, want them. You have to want it. Even the most holy yogi has to want union with the divine. It's nothing more than an acknowledgement of desire. If you pretend you don't have desire, then there is no chance of union because you won't want it. I am divided for love's sake, for the chance of union.
Now, you mentioned desire is a driving force or the driving force behind will. Is that correct?
Yeah, it has to be.
How does desire also incorporate agape or the love that's under will?
Agape is the desire for union with the spiritual. Agape is a form of love that unites not just on the sexual level, but on the spiritual level. If we don't desire that kind of union, then we get stuck at a certain place. There's a model that I use called the seven stations of desire that map to the chakras. I'm terrible at pronouncing the Sanskrit, so I won't even try. But it starts or ends, depending on how you look at it, you know, at the base chakra with simply the desire for manifestation. You know, I want to be. And it progresses up through the chakras with the desire for sexual union, the desire for personal power, the desire for agape, for spiritual union, the desire for self-expression, the desire for that vision of the truth, and finally the desire for the union with the divine. And you can map your own wants on that structure and find where it is that a particular desire is sourcing itself. And if it's appropriate, you can move it up and kick it up a notch. There's a Cadillac analogy that I use a lot because I've never particularly wanted a Cadillac, so it's easy. You know, where I want a Cadillac, you know, that desire for manifestation. Put a Cadillac in my yard right now. If I have a Cadillac, I'm going to get that really hot guy that I've always wanted because I know he likes Cadillacs and I know he'll be really impressed with me. And if I have that really hot guy because I have this Cadillac, then I'm going to have power. I'm going to be able to command this devotion, this love, whatever it is that I want to command by having this really hot guy. The respect of my friends who are going to go, wow, she got this really hot guy. And what do I want? Why do I want that? Because I want to feel connected to somebody. I want to feel connected to something. I want that spiritual union that comes from having people that admire me that I can admire back or that maybe I already do admire back. I want that other kind of joining of minds and spirit. And once I have that, then it's going to free me. I'm going to be able to say what I want to say. I'm going to be able to be who I want to be and express that freely. And when I can express that freely, I'm going to be able to see the truth. I'm going to be able to speak the truth and see it and perceive it, because that's what that self-expression, that's what being myself is going to get me. It's going to get me to a place where I'm free enough to see what's real and what's true. And once I have that vision, then I can approach the divine, and I will be one with the universe. And there's the desire for a Cadillac traveling up the seven stations.
I see. One of the things that kind of a red flag that always appears for me is the want versus will type thing, you know, how people misinterpret do what thou wilt as do what you want. Mm-hmm. And so since some people may be less familiar with Thelema and some of the concepts of will who are listening to this program, can you clarify how desire and your wants differ from, like, you know, I desire to do this little thing or that little thing or this transient want versus the desires to manifest your will? Can you specify those or just, you know, make the differentiation for people so that they can see how this desire is fueling the will versus transient whimsical wants?
Well, that's one of the beauties of working in meditation with these stations of desire, because it allows you to take a transient want, a want that appears whimsical like a Cadillac, and find really where it is. Now, it may not be appropriate to take it all the way to union with the divine, but you can see what it is that you're really getting at in wanting this apparently frilly, nonsensical thing like a Cadillac. And you can go, well, you know, really why I want that Cadillac is because I want these people to respect me. And then look back at it and say, well, is the Cadillac really the way to obtain the respect of these people that I admire and wish could see who I really am? And the answer will generally come back, often will come back, that no, that's not the best way. It would bankrupt your savings account. It would annoy, you know, whoever. It would, you know, put hardship on other people. And it's really not the best way to approach something like that. That desire for mutual respect, that desire for a meeting of minds, can very much be one of the stepping stones on the way to finding or expressing your will. The Cadillac probably isn't a necessary step. There's probably a better, cleaner, more direct way to do it. And it allows you to see it. It allows you to understand that this is not the only way. I don't really have to have the Cadillac. I don't really have to have the diamond ring. I don't really have to go out to this club and get totally drunk tonight in order to get to that place. There's other, better ways that I can get there. I don't need to indulge in this or that whim.
Now, you've explained how using the unified feminine for somebody could help them understand where particular desires fall in, and I think it would be safe to say, from understanding you, no desire or want is bad. It's just one needs to see where it is and what the usefulness of it, and, you know, not to fool themselves into thinking wanting the Cadillac is actually their will. They may want the Cadillac, and it may be fine for them to get the Cadillac, but it would be a foolish thing to think getting the Cadillac is part of their will. Is that correct?
Exactly. Most of the things that we want, especially in the early stages of our studies or explorations, turn out to be not quite tailor-made to our own will. We're very much products of our culture. Our culture teaches us what to want, so we look at our cultural background and we pick from the array of things that TV commercials and magazine advertising has told us that we want. We don't generally stop and force a break in that habit, and this can serve to do that. Force a break in that habit and allow us to take a much harder look at these things and realize that, well, it's the TV ad that told me that the Cadillac would make me sexy or the diamond ring would make me valuable or, you know, whatever it is. It's chosen from the array of things that are available to us through our cultural medium. And it's not always necessary or the right thing to move us forward on our path.
Now, would working with the unified feminine, would it also encourage one to look internally and become introspective in addition to looking at external desires?
Well, I think that it does that. Between the idea of the unified feminine and working with the model of the seven stations, it causes you to look at all of this external stuff that you're trying to manifest and come inside and bring it inside and see really what the interior workings of your will, your spirit, your soul, whatever it is that you want to attribute to that truth of who you are. It causes you to have to see it. You have to come turn inside. You have to walk into that brilliant darkness that illuminates the interior and shuts off all of the cultural messages and shuts off the social brain and see what your inside is made of and look at the demons that are hiding in the corners that are telling you this, that, or the other thing about who you are and who you need to be. and find the truth. And that's, you know, that's the most important thing. I think one of the most valuable things about this is using it as a way to discover your internal truth, the truth of who you are. No one can go very far if they don't know who they are and what they're about.
Now, I know this talk, that this 30 or so minutes that we've been talking is a real pared-down version of a longer day-long lecture that you give that's 4 or 5 hours. Isn't that correct?
There's a few different versions of it, but there is a day-long seminar that involves two different kind of lecture discussion sessions, one talking about the history and the more intellectual aspects, the second one dealing with the seven stations of desire and some meditations that are attached to that, and then winding up with an actual ritual in the latter part of the day that allows people to access these energies that are associated with the stations and do their own personal work with them.
Do you have any of these lectures planned anytime soon?
I'm hoping to be able to do one here sometime in the winter, in the early winter, and I do have a date picked. I've been invited out to Philadelphia to do the day-long version, and that, I believe, is the second weekend in May.
Second weekend of May next year?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
So, so hopefully I'll have the opportunity to do the day-long version of it. It's a pretty intensive one, but I think that it really does more than a half hour or a 2 hour or an hour and 15 minute lecture can do, because it gives people the opportunity to really get into it and work with it.
Well, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. If someone has more questions or wants to go to the lecture or presentations that you're giving either at the end of this year or the beginning of next year, how can they get in touch with you?
You can reach me at master@lvx-oto.org. There's also the text of the lecture or the basic essay of the lecture on our website under class notes, along with some supplemental materials. And the Scarlet Letter will be printing that essay, I believe, in this upcoming issue.
Excellent.
So there's a few different ways that people can access this kind of information. I would like to tag on to the end of this that this is not a women's only kind of current or energy any more than the current of Horus or Rahu or Kwet is only for men. This is very much a way of working that really can empower everyone equally, just as much as women need to be able to work with the male currents of Thelema. I think that, and it empowers us, that this is another aspect of it. This is more. This is something more for everyone to be able to use and access. There's a lot of men that when I'm done talking will come up afterwards and they're just relieved. They're just relieved that this is not this ugly radical feminism, this thing that devalues men, it's something that empowers them equally. So I just wanted to tag that onto the end because it's important to understand that when some of us are more empowered, some of us have more understanding, we all are. The Thelemic current embraces men and women as different and essential. And so this is a balancing that hopefully will bring more power to everyone and their ability to not only work within themselves, but to work within the community with each other. And I really hope that that message comes through.
Thanks for being on the podcast. And I'm going to link directly to the LVX website with your email address and a link to the document that you were talking about that has the excerpt from your lecture.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, John. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. 93.
93.
This brings us to the end of another podcast. Thanks again for spending an hour or more. It seems the shows are getting longer and longer. I just have so much to put on it. But I hope you stay tuned for future shows. I've got interviews with other well-known authors and personalities within the Thelemic and occult community. And also, I have added a new voicemail line, 206-20-AGAPE or 206-202-4273. This is a voicemail line that is specifically for the podcast. Please call and leave comments, and those comments could end up on the podcast. So I encourage you all to either email, leave comments on the Thelema Coast to Coast blog, the Thelema Coast to Coast website, or now you can call and give an audio comment directly on the Thelema Coast to Coast voicemail. Those audio comments will be sent to me in sound files, and don't be surprised if they show up on the podcast. Anyway, the last song is a rendition of Crowley's Hymn to Pan by the group Unto Ashes. This was pointed out to me by a listener named Roger, and I really appreciate that, Roger. Here's Unto Ashes, and thanks for listening to the show, 93.
I am thy man. Go to thy flock. I am gold. I am God. Flesh to thy bone. Flower to thy rod. With hoofs of steel, I race to the rocks. Through solstice stubborn, to equinox. And I rape. And I rend. Everlasting. World without end. Mannequin, maiden, maiden, man, in the might of Pan.